All right, good afternoon, everyone. This morning we concluded by retelling briefly the parable of the wise physician contained in chapter 16 of the Lotus Sutra, wherein we saw the Buddha Shakyamuni himself telling us that his appearance in the world as the Buddha Shakyamuni was just a manifestation of his Buddha activities, that it was just, let us say, one part, perhaps one of the principal parts, but still only one part of his role as a Buddha, as an enlightened one, to appear in the world in the form of the Buddha Shakyamuni, to demonstrate the abandoning of the household life, the struggle to achieve enlightenment, the teaching of the Dharma, and the passing away into Parinirvana. And all of this is recounted by the Buddha Shakyamuni himself, who, far from being extinct, is still very much present. Alongside of this revelation, we can call it, this disclosure that the Buddha Shakyamuni is still very much present, very much with us, very much active, we also see in the sutra the appearance of other Buddhas from past times. So within the context of the sutra, we find a Buddha from a very far previous age appearing. And that Buddha also is in perfect condition. That Buddha also is perfectly preserved, perfectly existent. He has not entered into extinction. He has not ceased to exist. He is also there, another Buddha of the previous ages, before Dipankara, before the various Buddhas that we know of from Buddhist tradition. Buddhist tradition, of course, acknowledges previous Buddhas, Vipassana, Kakunamuni, and so forth. But this Buddha is from the far, far past, and yet he appears in the Lotus Sutra in perfect condition, perfectly present for the benefit of living beings. So what is the message that the sutra wants to convey here? The message that the sutra wants to deliver is that none of the Buddhas, all the thousands of Buddhas that appear in the world or other worlds, that all of these Buddhas never enter into extinction, that all of these Buddhas are forever present and forever engaged in their Buddha activity. So there is no entry into extinction. The entry into extinction is just an expedient device. It's just a clever means for instilling energy into people of little virtue. This is the whole point of the passing into extinction. The Buddha has come, he has taught the Dharma, he has left, all we have is the Dharma. We should dedicate ourselves to practicing the Dharma and achieving the goal of the Dharma. We should not rely upon, we should not wait for the Buddha to save us from the world, but we should make efforts ourselves to achieve enlightenment and Buddhahood. So this is a matter of expedient means. This is a device, something the Buddhas manifest, something the Buddhas demonstrate. They appear to enter into extinction simply as a way of instilling zeal, instilling diligence. And we can reflect upon the last words of the Buddha again at this point: work out your deliverance, work out your own deliverance with diligence. Why? Because I'm entering into parinirvana. Now you're on your own. It's just as though a father were to say to his son, all right, now I'm going away, I'm going to a far away country, I'm going to leave you on your own, you can no longer rely upon me. This is a very common psychology, a very common strategy, even in the world. I know, to cite a very personal case, when my father first went to America, he went to join his father, who was already established there, and he expected to work with and for his father. When he got to America, my grandfather told him, no, you can't work for me. You have to go and work for someone else, because if you work for me, you'll never work seriously, because since I am the owner of the company and you are my son, if you work in this company, you will always expect some particular favor, some particular dispensation. So no, you have to go and work for someone else. My father, of course, was very upset by this, very irritated, angry about this. But the fact is, this was the idea. And in a certain sense, the Buddha entering into parinirvana, in his own way, is something like this. No, now you have to do it on your own. Now I'm no longer here to help you. But, of course, because of the compassionate attitude of the Mahayana, we do find out in due course that the Buddha is still there to help us. But in the meantime, at least we've had this shock of feeling that we are on our own, that we have to do it on our own, which of course in any case we have to do it on our own, because the presence of the Buddha doesn't mean that the Buddha will take us by the hand and lead us into liberation, take us by the hand and lead us to freedom. But what it does mean is that the Buddha does not abandon living beings, that the Buddha is forever present there. So all of this, the message of the parable in the 16th chapter and other parts of the Lotus Sutra, are about teaching by using skillful means or by using expedient methods. And what that means is, of course, teaching in a way that is in agreement with the needs and the capacities of the disciples, of the people to be taught. So the Buddha always teaches, has always taught, in accordance with the needs and with the capacities of living beings. That is the special gift of the Buddha, to be able to teach using expedient means, using intelligent means, skillful means, the term that we put on the board in the morning, upaya kaushalya or kushala upaya. The Buddhas teach using skillful means according to the capacity of the disciples. And at this point we can recall again the simile that we heard this morning about beings similar to lotuses in a pond, and how some of the lotuses are deeply submerged in the water, completely covered by the water. Some of the lotuses are just at the surface, on a level with the surface of the water, and some of the lotuses are quite well out of the water. And this simile, of course, is supposed to express the different capacities, the different abilities of living beings. Some living beings have middling abilities, some living beings have inferior abilities, lesser abilities, and some living beings have great abilities. So the Buddhas teach in accord with the ability of the living beings. And but that doesn't mean that their teaching is not relevant to all living beings, whether their abilities be minor or lesser, or whether their abilities be greater. And in order to demonstrate this, there's another chapter of the Loka Sutra where the sutra uses the simile of growing vegetation, or according to the title, the simile of medicinal herbs. But basically, what the teaching says is that rainfall and light benefit all growing things according to their position, according to their statement, according to their status, according to their situation. So when it rains, for example, as it does here in Songkhla and elsewhere, when it rains, all the growing things benefit from the rain. The great trees benefit from the rain. The shrubs and bushes benefit from the rain. The common grasses benefit from the rain. The crops, the grain and the vegetables and so forth, they benefit from the rain. But all according to their own need, all according to their own requirements. The rain falls impartially upon all, and all take what they need from the rain. All benefit according to their ability from the rain. The tiny insignificant grasses need less rain. The great trees, the shrubs and bushes require more rain. Each receive as much rain as they need. The rain falls impartially upon all of these growing things, upon all of these plants. And the rain, in this case, is like the Dharma, like the teaching of the Dharma. One of the stages of the Bodhisattva, one of the last stages, is called the stage is called Dharma Megha, the cloud of Dharma. And the Buddha, like a cloud of Dharma, releases its rain of Dharma, which falls impartially upon all living beings, and which benefits and nourishes all of them according to their ability, according to their need, according to their capacity. Similarly, we have the example of sunlight. The light of the sun affects living things and affects the landscape in the same way. When the sun rises in the morning, it touches first upon the higher mountains, then it touches gradually upon the lower slopes, finally it touches the valleys and the plains, but it touches all the various levels that are found on the surface of the earth. It lights up, it illuminates the landscape according to its position, according to its need, according to its place. So in the same way, the teaching of the Buddha shines upon all living beings, each and every one of them, according to their need. This is the activity of the Buddha. This is the activity of the Buddha operating through skillful means, born of great compassion, the transcendental Buddha can appear in various forms for the benefit of living beings. He can appear in the form of an historical Buddha, like the Buddha Shakyamuni. He can appear in the form of an arhat. He can appear in the form of a bodhisattva. He can appear in the form of a friend of virtue, a kalyanamitra. He can appear in the form of an ordinary living being. So the Buddha has this unlimited capacity to appear in various forms in order to liberate living beings. Now, why is this done? Why is this necessary? Why does the Buddha have to appear in all these diverse forms? Why does the Buddha have to undertake these strategies, these exercises in skillful means? The reason the Buddha has to undertake these exercises, why the Buddha has to devise methods, intelligent, expedient methods for instructing living beings, is that realizing the truth is not easy. I don't have to tell you all that. Realizing the ultimate truth, realizing how things really are, is not easy. For countless lifetimes, we have been circling in samsara. We have been building up erroneous ideas, mistaken ideas about what the world is and what it means, what the real state of things are. And it's not easy for us to understand the truth. It's not easy for us to realize how things really are. We need a lot of help, and we need to make a lot of effort. And some of us are more fortunate than others, because some of us may have had experience in the past. We may have met with the Dharma in the past. We may have practiced in the past. We may have had the opportunity to meet with masters, with arhats, or even with Buddhas in our previous lives. And so we have a greater aptitude for the Dharma in this life. Sometimes people wonder why it is that a particular person seems to have more capacity for meditation, seems to understand the teaching of the Dharma more quickly than others. The reason is because of experience in the past lives of that person. When persons have had more contact with the Dharma in past lives, then they find it easier to enter into an understanding of the Dharma in this life. When they've had less contact with the Dharma in past lives, then they need to work that much harder in this life in order to be able to understand the teaching of the Dharma. So it's a question of aptitude, it's a question of previous experience of the Dharma, but all living beings have different capacities. All living beings have different abilities to understand the Dharma. And so the Buddhas need to devise special methods. They need to devise expedient means in order to help living beings toward an understanding of the Dharma. And with regard to developing an understanding of the Dharma, it is important to remember that an understanding of the Dharma does not initially come instantly. It doesn't come in a moment. An understanding of the Dharma comes by stages. It comes by steps. Now, I know that there has been a lot of discussion about whether enlightenment is sudden or gradual and so forth. The fact is that even when something happens suddenly, it is preceded by a series of causes. Looking over the top of a wall may be sudden. Climbing up the wall is gradual. It is step by step. And that is true of any progress toward understanding the Dharma. It has to be preceded by gradual progress toward that moment of illumination, toward that moment of enlightenment. And for this purpose, the Buddhas have devised various means of teaching. Now, some of the more common and some of the more general divisions into kinds of teaching are the divisions into direct teaching and indirect teaching, nitartha and niartha. You want to put that on the board. And conventional teaching and ultimate teaching. Vyavahara and Paramartha, or Samvritti and Paramartha, depending on the context. Now all the various Buddhist traditions have different definitions of what is indirect teaching and what is direct teaching, what is conventional teaching and what is ultimate teaching. The Mahayana, nitartha and niyata, nitartha direct teaching, and then niyata is indirect, and then you can put vyavahara and paramartha. Vyavahara means, niyata means leading teaching, nitartha means going straight to the meaning, hence indirect and direct. Vyavahara means according to the usage of the world, according to the conventions of the world. Paramartha means the highest object, parama, highest artha, object or purpose, the highest object or purpose, the highest meaning, the ultimate truth. So these are some of the more general divisions of the teachings of the Buddha. So for example, if we refer again for a moment to the Theravada tradition and to the Abhidharmika tradition within the Theravada tradition, there too we have a division, and there the Abhidharma is regarded as the higher dharma, the dharma pointing to the ultimate truth. So in that context, it is said that when the Buddha says, for example, when the Buddha refers to persons and things, for example, when the Buddha refers to Devadatta and to Devadatta's house, this is an example of conventional usage, conventional teaching. When the Buddha says, when he refers to aggregates, to the skanda, when he refers to elements, to the factors, to the dharmas, then this is an example of ultimate teaching. So you see, it isn't convenient for us always to refer to people as a collection of processes, no? It isn't easy. I would find it inconvenient to say all the time that this collection of processes known as Mrs. Santina will now write on the board a collection of marks that form the word Vyavahara. is awkward, no? It doesn't. So it isn't necessary in the ordinary way of things. We can speak about persons and things, but from the ultimate point of view, we know that there are no persons and there are no things. There are only collections of processes, collections of elements. This, of course, is from the Abhidharmika point of view. In general, there is this distinction between the conventional truth and the ultimate truth, between the sutras of indirect meaning and the sutras of direct meaning. The teachings of indirect meaning, leading meaning, and the teachings of direct meaning. Now, of course, people, being what they are, have always argued over what was the direct meaning and what was the indirect meaning, what is the conventional truth and what is the ultimate truth. The Mahayana and the Mahayana schools set the mark, they raised the bar for ultimate truth very, very high. Very, very little of what we can express in language. In fact, virtually nothing of what we can express in words qualifies as ultimate truth, according to the Mahayana. So the fact that the Buddhas use skillful means, that they train people by stages according to their capacity, according to their ability, this is one of the principal themes of the Lotus Sutra. So just to recapitulate at this stage for a moment, the principal themes of the Lotus Sutra are, so far, those we have considered so far, are that the Buddha is a transcendental being, that the extinction of the Buddha and the appearance of the Buddha Shakyamuni in the world was just a manifestation of a transcendental, eternal Buddha, that the Buddha uses an infinite variety of skillful means in order to train living beings because of his great compassion. Out of his great compassion, he has recourse to, he devises the appropriate means, the expedient means of teaching living beings. And of course, this is also one of the particular qualities of the Buddha, one of the particular attributes of the Buddha. Why is the Buddha what he is? Why is the Buddha the Buddha? Why is he superior to the Arhat? Because over countless lifetimes, through the practice of the perfections, the Buddha has been able to develop an understanding of the capacity of living beings. He's been able to understand, been able to develop an understanding of the state of mind of various living beings, and he's been able to develop an ability to choose the methods that are suitable, that are most efficient for training, for leading those living beings. This, again, I say, this idea of skillful means, or upaya kaushalya, is very important for the whole Mahayana tradition. But it is not exclusive to the Mahayana tradition. It is not an invention of the Mahayana tradition. Even according to the Pali text, the Buddha makes use of skillful means. And this is a point which is important to remember. It's important to remember because, once again, I want to underline the fact that there is no radical revolution to be found in the Mahayana. The Mahayana was not a radical revolution. The Mahayana was not a break with the Theravada tradition. The Mahayana simply took certain elements which are also found in the Theravada tradition, certain aspects of the Buddha's teaching, and developed them, elaborated them. In this case, we have numerous examples of the Buddha, according to the Pali Theravada sources, using skillful means, using expedient methods of teaching his disciples. And this is evident almost without exception throughout the discourses of the Buddha that we find in the Pali Canon. The Buddha always used examples and similes. The Buddha always used in his discourses things with which his disciples, things with which his students were familiar. So, for example, you may have heard of the Buddha's dialogue with the with Sona, the former musician. You've heard this story? Some of you have heard this story? All of you have heard this story? About the monk Sona who was having difficulty with his meditation and went to the Buddha and said that, "I'm having difficulty with my meditation. I'm thinking about giving up the monkhood and going back to lay life and doing good works and so forth." Have you heard this story? Yes, some yes, some no, right? Okay. Just very briefly. So the Buddha said to Sona, he said, "Sona, you, before you joined the order, you were a musician, correct?" And Sona said, "Yes, that's correct." And so the Buddha said, "Well, tell me, Sona, then, which string of the lute makes a harmonious sound? Is it the string that is very tight?" And Sona said, "No, it isn't, Lord. It's not the string that is very tight. The string that is very tight doesn't make a pleasant sound. And moreover, it is liable to break at any moment." And then the Buddha said, "Well then, Sona, is it the string that is very loose that makes a pleasant sound?" And Sona said, "No, the string that is very loose, the string that is slack, doesn't make a pleasant sound." "So then, Sona, what string makes a pleasant sound?" "The string that is not too tight and not too loose." So in the same way, this is how you should practice meditation. Your meditation should not be too tight, you should not press too hard. On the other hand, you should not be too lax, should not be too loose, should not be too relaxed. And so the Buddha used this example with which Sona was very well familiar in order to teach him the middle way, in order to teach him to avoid the extremes of pushing too hard on the one hand and being too lazy on the other hand. And this, of course, is a teaching that applies not only to meditation, it applies to everything we do. Everything we do, we have to keep just the right balance between pushing too hard and being too lazy. If you push too hard, you can damage your practice. You can destroy your progress because your mind and body will become tired and frustrated. And if you're too lazy, you won't make any progress either. You have to find the right balance. So in this case, the Buddha used an example with which Sona was very familiar. Again, another time a prince came to the Buddha and asked the Buddha whether someone could achieve enlightenment within a relatively short period of time. How long would it take for someone to achieve enlightenment? And so the Buddha said to him, "Well, prince," I don't recollect the name of the prince now, it may have been Prince Abhaya. In any case, the Buddha said to the prince, "Well, you learned how to ride an elephant. you learned how to learn the skill of riding an elephant, controlling an elephant with a hook and so forth. How long did it take you? And the prince said, well, it took me a few days, a week, maybe two. And the Buddha said, well, it's just like that. If you want to learn to meditate, if your faculties are clear, if your health is good, if you apply the methods, you can learn to meditate just as easily as you learn to ride an elephant. It's simply a skill. So again, the Buddha took something from the life with which his disciples were familiar. Sona was familiar with the lute. The prince was familiar with the skill of elephant riding. And the Buddha took these phenomena with which his interlocutors, with which his students were familiar, and he used them as examples to teach the Dharma. This is the use of skillful means, finding things that the person is familiar with. This is a very, this is a very simple and by now almost a, this is recognized in so many walks of life. This is all part of communication skills. If you have to give a talk to people, if you have to, whether it be in business, whether it be in politics, you have to connect with those people. You have to talk about things that they understand, things that they know. There's no use going to talk to people in very distant terms about things that they don't understand. You have to begin where they are and build a bridge and gradually bring them along to understand what you are talking about. And the Buddha, even in the Theravada texts, even according to the Pali Canon, was a master of skill and means. There's a very famous encounter between the Buddha and a certain horse trainer. And this horse trainer came to the Buddha and he said, Lord, you are famous as a teacher of gods and men. Tell me, how do you train gods and men? And the Buddha said, all right, horse trainer, you tell me first how you train horses. And the horse trainer said, well, I train them by gentle methods. I train them by harsh methods. I train them by both gentle methods and harsh methods. And if they can't be trained, I kill them. And the Buddha said, well, I train men and gods in the same way. I train them by gentle methods. I tell them all of the benefits of practicing the Dhamma. I tell them how they will gain better rebirth and how eventually they will gain freedom from suffering if they practice the Dhamma. I train them by harsh methods. I tell them that if they fail to practice the Dhamma, they will suffer. They may be reborn in the hells or as animals and so forth. And I train them by both gentle and harsh methods. I tell them on the one hand of the benefits of practicing the Dhamma, and at the same time I tell them about the painful consequences of not practicing the Dhamma. So I use gentle and harsh methods together. And if I can't train them, I kill them. So the horse trainer was shocked and said, how can the Tathagata, you are the Tathagata, how can you talk about killing people? And the Tathagata said, what I mean is that if I can't train them, I ignore them. And for the Tathagata to ignore a living being is tantamount to killing him, in the sense that for the time being at least, he has no hope of progress because the Tathagata is unable to train him. The training does not have any effect on him. So in this respect, the Buddha explicitly says he trains living beings by different methods. And now I will just tell you one last story, which I think should make the point sufficiently clear, that even according to the Theravada texts and the Theravada tradition, the Buddha was very courageous in using skillful means. And this involves the Buddha's cousin Nanda, not Ananda, but Nanda. And some of you may have heard the story, I don't know, but the Buddha's cousin Nanda was ordained on the day before his wedding. And that also, the skillful means begins, in a sense, with the beginning of the story, in the sense that the Buddha has visited Kapilavastu, and the Buddha has taken his meal in Kapilavastu, and now he's returning to the Banyan Grove, where he was residing with the community of monks. And as he was about, before he took his leave and started on his way back to the monastery, he gave Nanda, his cousin, his bowl to carry. And Nanda didn't know what to do. He was getting married the next day. He didn't want to be rude. He didn't want to tell the Buddha, "Excuse me, Lord, I'm holding your bowl. Maybe you ought to take your bowl." So he carried the Buddha's bowl back to the monastery with the Buddha. And the Buddha said, "Oh, thank you for bringing the bowl. You know, the courtyard needs sweeping out. Maybe you should sweep out the courtyard." So Nanda begins to sweep out the courtyard, and every time he sweeps it out, it gets cluttered with leaves again. The leaves blow back, and there are leaves again in the courtyard. Anyway, to cut the story short, Nanda gets stuck. Literally, he gets stuck in the monastery. And instead of going back to town to get married the next day, he becomes a monk. The Buddha asks him to become a monk, he becomes a monk. Now, this is all very well and good. You might think this is rather drastic means of recruiting. But in any case, he becomes a monk. But that's not the end of the story. The problem is, Nanda becomes a monk, but his mind is not very content. He keeps thinking about his fiancée. He keeps thinking about leaving the order and going back to Kapilavastu and marrying his fiancée and so on and so forth. And the Buddha is aware of this. And one day the Buddha says, "Look, Ananda, come with me. I'm going to take you for a little trip." And the Buddha takes Nanda to the heavens, takes him to the heavens. And when they get to the heavens, he shows Nanda the heavenly maidens, the heavenly damsels. He shows Nanda a class of heavenly maidens called pink-footed nymphs. And he shows Nanda these pink-footed nymphs, and he says, "Well, Nanda, what have you got to say about these pink-footed nymphs?" And Nanda says, "Oh, they're so beautiful. They're so, my goodness. I mean, these pink-footed nymphs are just fantastic. You know, they're so lovely. They're so wonderful." The Buddha says, "Well, if you compare these pink-footed nymphs to your fiancée, what do you have to say? What would you say?" And Nanda said, "Oh, there's just no comparison. That skeleton of a monkey that we saw on the way up to the heavens, I mean, that is like my fiancée. These pink-footed nymphs are just infinitely more beautiful and more attractive than my fiancée." So the Buddha says, "Okay, Nanda, in your next life, if you practice, if you meditate diligently and you remain a monk and practice the Dharma, in your next life you will get 500 of these pink-footed nymphs." And Nanda says, "Really?" And the Buddha says, "Yes, really." And so they return they return to Earth, they return to the world, and Nanda begins to practice very seriously. He's meditating very seriously. He's behaving very, very well. And somehow, we're not told how, somehow the other monks come to find out why all of a sudden Nanda is so serious. And then they start to tease him about it. And as a result of their teasing, Nanda realizes that his motivation is maybe a little shallow, maybe a little worldly. Anyway, the moral of the story is that eventually Nanda becomes an arhat, and he becomes an arhat. Most of the arhats in those days had sort of designations or special names. And arhat and Nanda became the arhat known as the foremost in restraint, or the foremost in restraint and self-control. So this goes to show that even according to the Pali text, to what lengths the Buddha went in using skillful means. You know, he knew what Nanda wanted, and he promised him that, but he also knew that if Nanda did meditate seriously, if he did settle down, that his objectives would change. That what he wanted would change, that he would realize the futility, the emptiness, the superficiality of what he wanted. And that he would then gain higher fruits, something even better than 500 pink-footed nymphs. But the Buddha did not hesitate to use this carrot of the 500 pink-footed nymphs in Nanda's next life in order to wean him away from, in order to get him away from his obsession, his fixation with his human fiancé. So even according to the Pali text, the Buddha uses all kinds of devices, all kinds of skillful means in order to help disciples gain higher stages. This is learning by stages. This is, you know, similar to the training of children. We tell children, okay, you do your homework, you can watch TV for 2 hours. And with that device, we get them to do their homework. And then we hope, doesn't always happen that way, but we hope that eventually, if they study well, then they will become interested in their subject and they will develop a real vocation for their subject, and watching TV will not be so important. But we use the device of promising them that they will be able to watch TV or go to the movies or get a Game Boy or whatever it may be. We use these devices in order to pull them along, in order to draw them along by stages, to get them to do their homework, to get them to do what they are meant to do, so that in the end they will come around to the right objectives, to the right understanding. And in the same way, the Buddha uses different devices in order to instruct living beings, in order to bring them along by stages, knowing the dispositions of living beings, knowing what they want, what they're able to understand. The Buddha devises and implements expedient means in order to help living beings understand the truth by stages. Because living beings can't understand the truth all of a sudden. They can't understand the truth. Most living beings can't understand the truth if it is told to them straight away, if it is told to them directly, immediately. Most living beings, most people will have difficulty understanding and appreciating the truth if it is told to them directly, because they have too many wrong ideas, too many habits that have been formed in their minds over the course of countless lifetimes that obscure that make it difficult for them to see things as they really are. Because of this, the Buddha and the Buddha's disciples have to use skillful means, expedient means, in order to bring them to an understanding of the truth step by step, in order to bring them gradually around to an understanding of the truth. They can't be told the whole thing or the ultimate reality right away, because they wouldn't appreciate it, and they would probably just be frightened by it. So this is why the idea of skillful means is so important. And it's particularly important for the Mahayana, because remember the goal of the Mahayana, remember the ambition of the Mahayana. The ambition of the Mahayana is to bring all living beings to Buddhahood, to bring them all to Buddhahood. So if your ambition is to bring all living beings to Buddhahood, then you have to find a very great variety of expedient methods in order to cater to the needs of all these living beings, because you can't let any living being go. You can't give up on any living being. You have to find a way to help every single living being make a little bit of progress toward understanding the truth, make a little bit of progress toward gaining Buddhahood. And the only way to do that is to find out, to understand the state of mind of these living beings, and to formulate methods of teaching, methods of training that will help them to be able to understand, to appreciate, to gain an understanding, and to make progress toward liberation, to make progress toward Buddhahood. I'm going to talk next about the parable of the burning house, the house on fire, which is another important parable in the Lotus Sutra, and which also talks about and is also an example of the use of skillful means by the Buddhas, and is the Mahayana interpretation of the purpose and the reason for the teaching of the three vehicles, or yana, the three vehicles of the Shravaka, the Pratyeka Buddha, and the Bodhisattva.